Welcome to the healing power of your dreams here on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, dream expert Teresa Chung, and each week, along with recurring dream guest hosts Margarita Mitchell Pollock and Kelly Sullivan Walden, plus a special guest or two, we will dive deep into the out of this world ways your intuition by day and your dreams by night can guide, heal, and inspire you from the inside out. Expect insights, surprises, and the kind of healing wisdom that only your dreams can reveal. So join us live each week and let's discover the unexpected together. What if the dreams you have tonight could help create a kinder tomorrow? What if we all connected in our dreams to the higher love within and around us? I'm going to ask for a few bars of Liszt Liebestraum number 3 now. Love dreaming. Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it? If you listen to that, it heals your heart and soothes your soul. Music truly is the language of angels, as my upcoming guests always remind me. If you ever feel empty or depleted, just listen to that full flowing Dreaming of Love track. And try to listen before you go to bed tonight to set the scene or incubate dreams of higher love, because your night vision is a mirror to your inner world, and what is going on in your inner world is what you attract in your waking life. So many of the dreams we have today are anxiety-filled, stress dreams, chase dreams, dreams where we're falling late or losing something precious. And that's not a coincidence. Our dreams are mirrors of what we feed our minds and hearts during the day and especially before we go to sleep. If we go to bed worried, rushed, or fearful, that's what our dreaming mind works with. But if we begin to incubate loving thoughts before sleep, thoughts of compassion, connection, and hope, those qualities start to appear in our dreams. And when our dreams become kinder, it means our unconscious mind believes that kindness is real and kindness is possible. And if kindness is possible in our dreams, then it's possible in our waking life too. And that's how we change the world together, one dream, one day at a time. And today's show is all about love dreams and dreaming of a higher love, the kind of love that heals, connects, and transforms. And I am over the moon, delighted to introduce this week's extra special guest. Joining us is Stephen G. Post, or Post, as he always corrects me. It's not Post. I have been calling you Post all this time, and it's Post. Professor of Preventive Medicine at Stony Brook University and Director of the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care and Bioethics. Stephen is internationally recognized for his work on unselfish, compassionate love, exploring where science, ethics, spiritual wisdom and healing meet. You can find out more about his work at stephengpost.com. And he has just published a sublime book that should be required reading in schools and beyond, in my humble opinion. And it's called Pure Unlimited Love. And it's got a foreword by none other than perhaps the most spiritually influential person currently living, the Dalai Lama. And later in the show, I'm thrilled to be joined once again by my stunning recurring dream co-hosts, Margarita and Kelly, who will be bringing their insight, warmth, and dream wisdom into the conversation. For those of you who are new to the show, I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert and serial author, and you can discover more about my work at my website and on Instagram at The Teresa Chung. And as Valentine's Day approaches, it feels especially fitting to share that my next title is all about finding a higher love. It's called Your Twin Flame Journey, a guide to your soul's most passionate connection, a deep dive into the love that awakens the soul and shows up not just in life, but in our dreams. So stay with us because today we're exploring how love begins in the dreaming mind and how it can ripple out into the world. Thank you, Stephen. It's lovely to see you because although this is radio, I can actually see you on the Zoom for the first time because we have spoken before. But thank you for joining us. Hello.
I'm greatly pleased to be with you, Teresa. I love your energy and I love your program.
Thank you so much. And I love all your books. I have read them all. I adore your work. And I'm so glad that we were able to book you for this show because we actually organized this months ago because you're such a busy person. But Stephen, for listeners who may be discovering your work for the very first time, could you just introduce yourself and share what first drew you into exploring compassion, love, and healing at the intersection of science, medicine, and spirituality?
Well, I have been at this since the age of 15. I was at an Episcopal, call it Anglican in the UK if you wish, high school in Concord, New Hampshire, and I had a dream. I was noted by my peers as being relatively saturated with world religions at that time, and I would be peripatetic. I could easily walk down the beautiful pathways in New Hampshire, surrounded by fall leaves, and be reading the Upanishads or whatever it might be. And I had a reputation for that. I was more of a spiritual figure than an ice hockey player. And I had a dream. I had a class called Ancient History Sacred Studies. And it was a beautiful class about world religions. And then in that 15th year of my life, I had a dream. And it was a fantastic and a shaping dream. I woke up, I was kind of betwixt and between sleep and wakefulness. And I was on a path that I knew was headed to the west, but I couldn't see very far on it. It was covered with fog, and I could make out the facial expressions of a young guy with dirty blonde hair who was about to jump off a ledge to my left. And I looked at him, and then into the path came the face of a wonderful young woman, a blue angel, I would call her. And she said in a very soft tone, "If you save him, you too shall live." Of course, I went around and told all my friends, including Charlie Scribner and lots of wonderful people up there who had illustrious literary backgrounds. And they eventually came around to thinking that I was telling them exactly what had happened because it repeated itself six times. And that really made me believe early in life that there is this one mind, this universal one consciousness. And I've always accepted that. It's been verified through many events and vignettes in my life over the years, and I've always stuck with it. And that's why I love teaching, and I love teaching about that. I have to be a little bit cautious in a heavily scientific medical school, but it works out for me because I don't get heavy-handed. I just wait for people to knock on my door. And they say, "What is this business about God and love on Route 80?"
Do you find that with your peers as well? That, maybe not in the conference, but they'll take you aside and say, "Hey, I've had a dream coming true." I
Yes.
said I relate to what you're saying, but maybe not in en masse.
Well, actually, it's quite common, I find. People are inhibited, but I'm in the business of disinhibiting them and allowing them to be freer in expressing their inner intuitions. So I had lots of people when God and Love on Route 80 came out, which is all about synchronicity and dreams and such things. Many people came to my door and knocked and said, "You know, I read that book you wrote, and I just want you to know that I've had that experience too." And then they would really relish the opportunity to share that experience with me. I might take an hour or half an hour or even 2 hours and just listen very attentively to them and give them some feedback. Not that I'm a good interpreter of dreams like Kelly probably is, but I did my best and I do my best. And I think that I really enjoy being in a highly scientistic environment. This is pure scientism at Stony Brook. And yet, despite all of that, people are extremely spiritual. So we did a national survey of adult Americans in 2013. And what we found out was that even though many of them did not go to church or synagogue or mosque or whatever, 81%, this is in the God and Love and Route 80 book, but also in Pure Unlimited Love, 81% say, "Yes, I've had an experience of divine love." And half of them say it was direct, mystical, if you will. And half of them said it was in answer to a prayer, and just the right person showed up and had just the perfect thing to say. And it liberated me and freed me and gave me new hope. So for some, it's synchronicity. For some, it's direct. And it was really quite amazing. And then of that 81% of Americans, half of them have this experience quite regularly, certainly more than once. And then there's, if you split that in half, these are people who have it all the time. They just feel this constant presence of divine love, and it animates them and motivates them. And of course, they all score higher in purpose in life and in compassion.
And you've pioneered the compassionate path as a way to live life and have healing from the inside out. In all your books, that message comes across loud and clear. And I know Margarita, she's so interested in your Blue Angel dream. So we're going to pick up on that later. And I know Kelly is going to take a deeper dive into Pure Unfiltered Love, your latest title. But before we do, for personal reasons, and I'm being a little selfish here, I'd like to just backtrack a bit to your title before this one, about your work in compassionate care for people living with dementia, because my husband has Alzheimer's and your writing has been deeply meaningful to me. I adore your book, Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People. It really, really helped me at a low point. But can you explain for people listening, many of them who may be in a care situation like me, because dementia, millions across the globe suffer from this, why you believe compassion remains so vital even when memory and cognition are fading?
Fading but never gone. The brain is not the source of consciousness. It's not the source of mind, if you will. It is a platform, for sure. And it can affect adversely the manifestation of mind or consciousness. But consciousness is not derived from material, from matter, from cells, from tissue. It is probably first of all things. And matter, if you believe the Hindus and most of the mystics of the world, matter is derived from mind. So when I was a student, I was at the University of Chicago for quite a few years, and I studied with a wonderful Australian neuroscientist who got the Nobel Prize, Sir John Eccles. Who was at Oxford for a while too. And he would tell me all about how brain cells communicated with each other at the synapse. And he was the one who discovered all of that. But he also said, don't ever let anyone seduce you into what he called nothing buttery, that the mind is nothing but the brain. And that's just beautiful because too many neuroscientists, about split actually, do think in terms of nothing but brain. And I've always thought of the mind as much more mysterious and much more profound. It's like you can't get blood out of a stone. You've heard that expression. I don't think you can get mind out of matter. They're just entirely different in every way imaginable. But there are probably a half a dozen serious theorists who think they can explain how that can happen. I just don't think it does.
Agree. And in Dignity for Deeply Forgetful People, you write powerfully about the importance of dignity. But what does that really mean in the context of dementia care? And how can carers and families preserve a sense of personhood when so much seems to be slipping away, not just for the person they're caring for, but for themselves?
Those are very deep questions, and I actually wrote Dignity very much for caregivers to give them a perspective. You'll notice I don't really accept the word dementia because it's structured very much like the word retard. It's a very negative word, and it conjures up negative metaphors. And so sometimes in clinical settings, you hear metaphors like gone, husk, shell, empty, and those kinds of things. And what that does is it blinds us to the continuing presence, even though it may be opaque, of a spiritual entity, of a soul, if you will. So I did a national survey with the Gallup organization 4 years ago. And this was focused on primary caregivers across America, thousands of them. And we asked them, had they ever had an experience of surprising lucidity that they saw in their loved ones? And about half of them had had very astonishing such experiences. And then we asked them, so what did that mean to you? And they said, well, it inspired them because now they knew they were caring for someone who was still there. And you know, in the book, there's a chapter entitled "Is Grandma Still There?" And I've run into a lot of grandkids, and they've asked me, "So is she still there?" And I can never say no because that would be completely arrogant and scientifically unsound. So I believe that there is a continuing identity, and one of my greatest mentors, an African American pastor in Cleveland, a very famous guy who Oprah identifies as her major mentor in life. His sister passed away of probable Alzheimer's about 2 years ago. And I called him on my cell phone and I said, Pastor, do you think she's still there? And he paused because he was a very thoughtful guy. And slowly he said, well, I think she's still there, or maybe she's gone down to the Amtrak station and she's already got 1 foot on that blessed train for glory.
Wow, between worlds. That's
Yeah,
right.
between worlds.
She's between worlds, and
So he's a step ahead of us.
she's got all the angels in heaven on one side and the people who love her on the other. She's okay, and the carers need to maybe understand that their essence remains, even if their cognition is.
Yeah, so when the caregivers are asked, so what did these experiences of unexpected lucidity mean to them? You, of course, 10% of caregivers said it was frustrating because they don't these experiences do not last. They are relatively fleeting. On average, they might last 3 to 5 minutes, but sometimes they can last longer. Sometimes they're stimulated by music or art or social interaction. Sometimes they're totally sporadic. But for 90% of people, they are inspiring because, again, they realize that love still matters because their loved one is still there and can be reached. And I always say to caregivers, sing with your loved one.
Music can reach parts of the brain and the heart and the soul. As I said in the beginning, it's the language of angels, and you taught me that. Stephen, thank you. We're going to have to pause now for a short break, and when we return, we'll continue exploring how love, compassion, and dignity show up not just in life, but in our dreams. Please stay with us.
The station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise, elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to The Healing Power of Your Dreams, and I'm Teresa Chung, and today we're exploring higher and higher and ever higher love through the dreaming mind with Stephen G. Post. And now I'm delighted to hand over to my dream co-host, Margarita Mitchell Pollock, who is a journalist with the Sunday Times and a TV producer. And she's going to talk more to Stephen about how compassion and love are reflected in our dreams. Margarita, take it away.
Thank you very much, Teresa. I'm delighted to be here to talk to you, Stephen. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to talk with you as well.
So Stephen, I was listening there about the dream, and I couldn't help but think you've missed out the most important part of that dream for me, which was the man on the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yes.
Please tell me about it's about 8 o'clock in the morning. It's misty. You can
yes.
barely see 4 or 5 feet in front of you. I've been on the Golden Gate Bridge. I went to San Francisco for my honeymoon. I know that bridge. And you came across somebody that day, that morning, didn't you?
Yeah, and that was before they had all the railings up and so forth. It was quite a while ago. It would have been 1969, believe it or not. But, you know, I was heading up to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, which was a great place to be. And I had run away from home. I know that's a little shocking for you to hear, but I'd had a fairly significant argument with my parents about wanting to be a tutor in the Bronx, and they both felt that that was too dangerous. And this went on for several days. And I asked my dad, so what should I do? And he said, "You can get a job in Bill De Bono's lampshade factory." So I cut cardboard for several weeks. But then eventually, my intuition was to go west. So I took Dad's Mercedes 190, it had seen much better days, drove west on Route 80, and then it conked out in the middle of Pennsylvania. And I wrote a note to the Pennsylvania police, "Please return this car to Henry A.V. Post, 44 Davison Lane East, West Islip, New York, 516-669-5655, from his son Stephen, who is no longer working in the lampshade factory." And I just headed west and spent the summer with my cousin George Lamont in San Francisco in the Mission District. And I drew a very bad number for the Vietnam draft. So I decided, maybe I really will go to college. And I was meeting in front of the Buddhist temple in the Mission District on Chenery and Mission. And I met with all my old friends early in the morning, and I got a bus to Golden Gate Park. I walked across the park, and there was that red stone entrance into the bridge. And I walked across it because that's north, and Oregon is north from San Francisco. And as I got to the very middle of that huge span, I heard a kind of scratching noise to my left. I squinted and I looked over, and there was the face of a young man with blonde hair, and he seemed very much like the person I saw in my dream.
Yes,
And he,
powerful,
yeah, and he was
very
a ba
powerful
and
moment.
very, very powerful, life-transforming,
Yes,
actually.
for both of you.
Yeah, because I had no idea what the dream really meant, but now I was getting a better idea. So I looked at him and I said, "I hope you're not planning to jump." And then he responded with a whole lot of very nasty cursing language because I had interrupted what for him was a sacred and final moment. And then he said, "Who are you to tell me that?" And I explained to him that I had this dream at St. Paul's. I had an argument with my parents. I had come all the way across the country following my road to the West and the voice of an angel. "If you save him, you too shall live." And he was completely mesmerized. He thought I was crazy. Of course, I said, "I'm not crazy. You're the one that's standing out there on the ledge." But I said, "Look, if you come over this fence, I'm going to give you something that will change your life." And I had been that summer hanging out with the Nichiren Shoshu Buddhists. And that morning I left, they had given me a gahonzon, which is a scroll. It's a scroll that has lots of beautiful symbols on it, one of which is a heart with a line through it, which means no heart. It's the Japanese symbol for busy and the like. But there were lots of wonderfully positive symbols there about the one mind. And I said, "Let me unroll this and I'll explain it to you." So we spent about a half an hour, and I said, "Look, I will give you this." He was completely thrilled to have it. I said, "I will give this to you for free," because I had to pay $40 for it. "But here's a note to my cousin George Lamont, who later became very wealthy because he made Lamont gloves." I said, "I will give this to you. Take this note to my cousin George on Chenery Street, 16 Chenery Street, and just knock on the door and tell him Stephen sent me." And it said, "Dear George, please let this wonderful young guy sleep on your floor exactly where I slept on your floor for 2 months." And that worked out. I never saw that young man again, but when I would come up for or go down to San Francisco from Oregon for vacations, I learned that he had gone out to North Carolina, where he was from, with a gal friend, and apparently was doing quite well. So somehow or another, it worked out for him. And I knew what the dream was for, and I knew why I had it, which was to bring me out there 3,000 miles away
Yes.
And
Synchronicity.
2.5 years after I'd actually had the dream.
Yes, it led you there. This is what I love about you, Stephen, is that you tell that story so beautifully and so eloquently. And that was the story I was after. I was like, give me that powerful story. I want it. But what I love about your spirit, it's so generous. And what you say it so kindly, but you saved that man's life, you know, and you say it so humbly. You saved that man's life. What would have happened if you hadn't been there that morning? You know, really allow yourself to realize the work you do. You touch many lives, Stephen. You know, and I'm sure wherever that man is today, and all the life you touch with your books, just recognize that in your work and the things you do.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. It's so nice of you to comment like that. You know, so I made it up to Portland, Oregon. I actually, as I got to the bottom, the north side of the bridge, I had my thumb out and a farmer's truck came by. It was a red Ford Ranger. And this guy opened his window and he said, "Where are you going, boy?" And I said, "I'm going up to Oregon." And I said, "Could you give me a ride?" And he said, "Well, we're going most of the way. Jump in. My name's Duane Dill." These are memorable moments. And then in the passenger seat was a woman, his wife, and she said, "Yeah, jump in. I'm Dorothy Dill, Dill, just like in Dill Pickle." I'll never forget that.
You won't forget
So,
that, no. I was going to say that's a memorable moment.
I got up to Oregon, and it was an amazing experience. But in January of that year, I was in the coffee shop, and Steve Jobs was at Reed at that time, and we interacted. We read the autobiography of a yogi a bit on the floor of my dorm room,
Wow.
so one night I was sitting in the coffee shop, and a guy came bounding in with a black motorcycle jacket on, and he looked pretty lit up, if you will. And he said, "My name's Andy. I've got a brand new Harley Davidson shovelhead motorcycle. It's the fastest bike in the world. And because my frontal lobes were still immature, as they are with most males, I said, 'I'll go.' He said, 'Who wants a ride?' I said, 'I'll do it.' So I went out and I jumped on this thing, and it was raining out and a little bit slushy. It doesn't snow up there, but it does get slushy. So this fellow, Andy, he just hit on the accelerator, and he made it to 150 miles an hour very quickly, going through every stop sign, every light. He went out on the Pacific Coast Highway. He was screaming into the wet rain, blowing red into his face, and I thought I was dead. I really did. I felt it was the end of my life, and I actually did shed some tears, and I begged him to let me off, but he wouldn't do it. So I knew the end was near. But then finally, in this incredible moment, he stopped and he did this shockingly brutal U-turn over the midway. And he drove back, hitting 180 miles an hour, drove me right back to where he picked me up and let me off. And I staggered across a bridge, a wooden bridge over the ravine, and got to my dormitory, Ackerman. Now, I never, Margarita, they had payphones in those days.
Well, I know what you're going to say, Stephen. You see, I too have an Irish Catholic mystic mother, and I know exactly what happened next because I can relate 100% to what your mother said to you on that phone. So tell us what happened.
So I literally staggered. I didn't have much balance left. I staggered into the common room and the phone rang. And I never picked up the phone, and I'd given my mother the telephone number some months earlier just so that she would have peace of mind. And lo and behold, the phone rang, and I felt a little push on my right shoulder. I didn't see anything. I've never seen anything, but I felt, somewhat pressured to pick up the phone. So I picked it up and I said, "Hello." And it was my mom. And she said, "Thank God you're alive." And she had been sleeping and she woke up. She was sweating profusely. She thought I was dead. And I said, "Mom, I thought I was dead too." And then we talked for a while. She being an Irish mystic, we wondered about how it is that two people in the context of love, even though I'd stolen the family car not too long before, I left it on the highway. But we wondered how it was that she could have that feeling about me in New York, and I'm on the West Coast,
The power of the
and
mother's love.
it's a mother's love.
Yes, the
And there
power
are
of the bigger
some
universe.
researchers who have felt that a mother's love is a kind of conduit for this connectivity of mystery. And I believe that to be
Interesting.
true.
Interesting. Well, not to quote Harry Potter at you, but I always thought it was a very powerful part of the story of Harry that his mother's love protected him from what, Voldemort, the darkest energy in the universe, and that was what protected him, the boy that lived. And I thought that was always very clever because I writing about mother's love at the moment, so I can completely relate to also having an Irish Catholic mystic mum, and I know what it is to grow up with premonitions and predictions about dreams and synchronicity. And I hear in your voice you talk a lot about synchronicity and intuition. And could you talk a little bit to me now about how that plays out in your life? All I hear are these amazing stories that have divinely signposted you to where you are today. For people that maybe don't know how to pick up on that, or maybe not as tuned in, how do they hear that voice?
Well, sometimes it'll just hit you right in the nose and you know it. But sometimes it's more subtle. And I believe that Larry Dossey has helped us learn the value of the word noticing. It's a bit of a neologism in spiritual thought, but you have to notice these moments of synchronicity. Now, Carl Jung wrote about synchronicity, and he said, you can describe it not in terms of normal cause and effect, but in terms of quote uncaused causality, capital U, capital C. And his story, he was interacting with a client in his office, and he wasn't making any progress with her at all. And she spoke suddenly about a dream she'd had that night about a very rare silver beetle in Northern Europe. No one sees it really, it's extremely rare. And Jung swiveled his chair around and he saw that beetle on his window pane. And he picked it up, put it in his hand, and he brought it over to her. And she was completely astonished by it. And at that point, she opened up and they had a very productive therapeutic relationship or healing relationship, therapy meaning healing. For many years. So you could call that an occasion of synchronicity. And he saw it because he believed that synchronicity occurs not just in these kinds of perfectly timed interactions between human beings, but sometimes between human beings and other species.
I
So that
believe
beetle was there
it.
for a reason.
I absolutely believe it. And the thing about synchronicity, I feel it's synchronicity that I'm speaking to you today, Stephen, that Teresa has brought us all together on this fantastic show. I have so much more I want to speak to you. You'll have to come back on because I want to speak to you about your work on mirth and laughter. And but I am going to pass you over now to my colleague Kelly Sullivan Walden, and she's going to deep dive into your latest book. But it's been a pleasure, Stephen. And before I go, also please could you do some meditation? I think you've got the most calming, beautiful voice. I could listen to it all night.
Well, so do you.
Thank you.
It's
Lovely.
an honor.
Thank
Thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Oh, I love that conversation, Margarita, Stephen. I hope you're enjoying this sort of like two-pronged attack, which is now going to be a three-pronged attack, but I hope it's a gentle nudge rather than an attack. So let's return now with Stephen. And I'm so happy to welcome our very own Kelly Sullivan Walden, Dr. Dream, who always brings such heart and surprises to our dream time together. Over to you, Kelly.
Oh my heavens, I am having such a great time on this show today. Thank you so much for everybody, for Teresa for having me and Margarita for co-hosting with me and Stephen G. Post. Your book has rocked my soul. I've had quite a week reading your book, The Pure Unlimited Love. So you make a case for what happens when you're kind. There's this glowing effect. You say glowing is a paradoxical and unintended consequence to giving with kindness. So I'd love, you did scholarly papers on this, over 50 of them in psychological and scientific journals. So can you talk a little bit about that? If people are wondering, I want to glow, why can't I glow? I just repel people. How do I get that glow? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I do use the language of give and glow. And it resonates with the idea of radiance, which is something more than happiness. Happiness gets so overly used today, and there are so many bad books about what it is. Some of them are purely hedonic, but the given glow is a spiritual glow, and you unleash your eternal soul when you give with kindness, and you're not concerned about paybacks. So I've been working on this topic for at least 30 years and did a book called Why Good Things Happen to Good People, How to Live a Longer, Happier, Healthier Life Through the Simple Act of Giving. And that was in 2007. It was the first time I tried my hand at a non-academic publication, and I was very glad that I did. It changed my life. But, you know, when you give in that kind sense, it unleashes a whole neurological pathway, the mesolimbic pathway. And so you're flowing with happiness chemicals. I'll use the word happiness in this context, joy chemicals, if you will, including dopamine, but also others that are associated with positive psychological states. And it also is the case that the brain is structured in such a way that when you're focused authentically and kindly on giving, it shuts off all of those negative pathways where you have destructive emotions like rumination, bitterness, hostility, hatred. Those things cannot remain turned on when you're in the state of give and glow. And that we've demonstrated very clearly. So give and glow is really liberating for people. And that's why in the UK now, they have something called social prescribing in the national health system. And some of that was based on why good things happen to good people, because I had been spending some time at St. Hugh's College in Oxford back in 2000 and met with some NHS people. And it's now in 30 different countries that link workers in primary care settings mainly, but other settings as well, psychiatry, are actually facilitating patients being able to operationalize their desires to be generous and to be kind and giving. And they set them up with all kinds of different local programs, and it works very beautifully. So in the book, I lay out, 12 different areas of medical care where patients benefit from getting out and doing things for people. It's not just AA, the 12 steps, which is so famous. And the last step, the 12th step, is to help other individuals who are struggling. There's a long story about that, and I won't go into it, but it's the same with pain patients, so long as they're able to get up and help others. We have a program here at Stony Brook called Mended Hearts. So people who have had major heart surgery then visit individuals who are newly on the unit and probably anxious and fearful. And they sit down and they explain to them what's going on and tell them they'll be okay. So the first conference I had on compassionate care was at MIT in October of 1999. And Dame Cicely Saunders herself flew over from St. Christopher's Hospice to be there because she had gotten the Templeton Award years back. And Sir John was one of my mentors, and he was there at the conference. So she gave the dinner speech. And you know what she said, Kelly? She said, I'm 82 years old, and I still go into St. Christopher's every morning without fail. And I change bedpans first, because she'd been a nurse before she became an MD. And she was thankful that she'd had the opportunity to help people in that humble sense. And then she said, I switch gears and I sit on the end of beds. And I ask people, what's the most positive and meaningful thing in their lives? She called that dignity therapy, getting to a word we were using earlier. Because she said that the worst thing is when people are in their final hours or days and they're harping on the things they wish they could change. Oh, I wish I'd married someone else. Or maybe I should have been something different. Or I took the wrong turn in the road on Route 80.
Glad you didn't take that wrong turn.
I didn't.
Glad you left your car.
Thank heavens for the Pennsylvania police. But
Thank
anyway,
God.
so that's what she said she did, and that her life was meaningful at that time. And then she flew back and she died about a year later. We did raise some money for St. Christopher's Hospice, happily, and she was very delighted. And I have a stack of letters from her way, way back in the day. But she was a beautiful person, and she was always luminous. She was They should have described her as luminosity or radiance, because that's how she was. And one other thing too, about 4 months ago, I was in New York at Lincoln Center, because I'm still with the Templeton Foundation as a senior fellow. And that was when the Green Patriarch got the Templeton Prize, this head of all the Eastern Orthodox churches. And the person who introduced him was Jane Goodall. So I had dinner with her that night. And, it was beautiful because, I mean, she'd also gotten the Templeton Prize. She was so wonderful because she said, I'm so grateful to have changed people's attitudes toward non-human primates, but also human nature itself, because we are related to the non-human primates. And we're not just swashbucklers, needing to be controlled by force, but there's something inherently compassionate and kind in us. And so she started writing things, The Ape Within, and I was just so grateful to her, because I said, you change people's thinking about human capacity.
Yes. Oh, you and I are going to have a longer conversation at some point about this. My husband and I did work with the Gorilla Foundation, and
Oh.
we did my husband and I, well, my husband produced an album for Coco the Gorilla, and we got to know that. So it's there's so much to say there. It's the and their dreams, the dreams of these gorillas are
Yes.
incredible. So they are so intelligent, and if they're intelligent, then it's not just about kindness to people, but these beings, these animals are also sentient. But I
Yes.
want to bring something up to you, and I
So
hope
important.
this I feel like this is a little spicy of me to bring up, so please bear with me. I'm kind of nervous and I'm sweating just bringing it up because this is important to me very selfishly personally. So there was an Elizabeth Gilbert talk that came out years ago on the divine feminine and the divine masculine versus the profane feminine and the profane masculine. And in it, she talks about how the Buddha and Jesus at some point came out after it had been popular. Like it was the coolest thing in the world if you had all the power and all the might. That made you an important person. And then comes Jesus and Buddha, and they're talking about no, kind of the coolest person is the kindest person. And there was this thread. And so Christianity, Buddhism, there's all kinds of other religions that come out and say similar things. But what Elizabeth Gilbert's saying is, so this is the snarky part, but women were already like this. Women, most women, now I'm not generalizing exactly, I'm going to speak in black and whites, but most women are already pure unlimited love. We'd
Yes.
give anything to anybody. And in some ways, what she's talking about, we become the profane feminine when we give too much, when we double down on the giving, when maybe this book, even though for me, I got so much, I felt my own glow-o-meter turn up in the reading of your book, Pure Unlimited Love. However, what I've been learning lately and what I've been working with my clients on is boundaries.
Yes.
And Teresa was talking about, taking care of her husband and being a caretaker. And sometimes maybe that oxygen mask needs to go over our own mouth to be kind to ourselves. So I hope that wasn't too snarky. How do you
Not at
feel
all.
about how do you feel about
Oh
that?
yeah, so I've always been very careful. I teach in a big medical center, and there are problems with fatigue, burnout, and the like. Because these people are already committing themselves to sometimes 24/7 care of patients. And I see them, I walked into this building this morning and I saw someone who just looked very, very tired. And we talked for a little while. But that's a reality. And so when you say give and glow, it's addressed primarily to people who have sort of everyday jobs. And our national survey, which we did with UnitedHealthcare when I first got to Stony Brook from Cleveland in 2010, we asked 5,000 American adults if they had volunteered the year prior in 2009. And guess what? 42% of them had. And then we asked them, how did it make you feel? And it was amazing. It's actually in the first chapter of the book. 78% say it made them feel more resilient, made them feel physically healthier, and it goes on and on, made them feel happier. But the point is that that's not always the case. And it's certainly so that people need to step back. And I have a chapter in the book, May You Cherish the Gift of Nature. I think it's so. I'm not too clinically active, but I actually take a ferry boat from Long Island across the Long Island Sound to Bridgeport, Connecticut. I don't get off, but I get a round trip ticket and I ride back. And with the waves and the seagulls and the beauty of it all, I'm inspired. And I sometimes have to do that because if I don't, I stumble in my writing and my teaching, in my relationships with students and so forth. So you need to take time to nurture your soul. And when you say that non-human life matters. I'm totally for that. And I talk in the chapter about nature deficit disorder, which is not a formal psychiatric term now, but it's coming along. It's a lot of talk about making it one because people
Yeah.
completely locked into their
Yeah.
AI devices and so forth. I think we need to be very careful about that and just get them freed up so that they can connect with the natural world, because that is the gift of the supreme being.
Oh, that is so true. I love that nature deficit disorder. We need more time in nature, even just one little leaf on one little tree. And from a dream perspective, just to loop it around to dreams, there's a kindness to the parts of ourselves that we dream about, even the parts of ourselves that are difficult to love, that are within ourselves, that show up in the dreams as some of the saber-toothed tigers that chase us. And at some point, when we get a chance to talk longer, I want to talk about that blue angel. You said it was an angel before, and I was like, wait, did you say blue angel? There's a whole phenomenon of people that dream about blue angels. So I think that needs to be the topic of an entire show to itself. Speaking of angels, we need to loop right back to our beautiful hostess with the mostest, Teresa Chung. Stephen, this has been so lovely connecting with you. Thank you.
Thank you for
Thank you,
having me,
Teresa.
Billy.
Thank
Appreciate it.
you.
Thank you.
Oh, I just blissed out listening to this. My feet up here, it's wonderful. Thank you so much. And as we come to the end of today's journey, I want to give my heartfelt thanks to Stephen G. Post on behalf of myself, the recurring dreams that are Margarita Mitchell Pollock and Kelly Sullivan Walden, and all of us here at UK Health Radio, for sharing such sublime wisdom, compassion, and hope with us. Today's been a reminder that love is not just something we think about or talk about, it's something we practice, something we feel, and something we do. It lives deep within us, even beyond memory, words, space, and time. So as you prepare to go to sleep tonight, I invite you once again to take a moment to incubate loving, grateful thoughts before you drift off. Because when your dreams are shaped by love, your unconscious begins to believe in love's healing power. And what your unconscious believes, I never tire of saying this, everyone, while you dream, what your unconscious believes in while you dream, you carry with you into your waking life. This is how healing begins, one timeless heart at a time, one dream at a time. Gonna leave now with Stephen's song choice, and all you precognitives out there, I'm wondering if you're guessing what it might be. I'm gonna give you a beat. Come on, write down just your first intuitive thought. What do you think Stephen G. Post chose to end this show with? Okay.
Dreamweaver.
No,
Okay, I'm wrong. Gong.
it's Kelly, and it had to be Bring Me a Higher Love. So take it away, and until next time, everyone, sleep kindly, dream wildly, and dream only of love.